going to be about how to interpret the quantum state. Does it describe reality? Does it describe our knowledge of reality? It's one of my favorite topics. But it's going to be a response to the Pusey-Barrett-Rudolph theorem, which is this big result that Lucien talked about. And a lot of people have taken this as evidence that one should not interpret the quantum state as a state of knowledge, but rather as a state of reality. So I want to give you sort of my views on that, and then sort of go from there forward to talk about what I think is likely to be a fruitful direction for how to interpret quantum theory. So I need to start by giving you some of the key distinctions and notions that I'm going to use in the talk. And a lot of these I've talked about many times before, so I'm not going to go into too much depth. If you want a minimal interpretation of quantum theory, you can use an operational interpretation. So there, the idea is that the elements of the formalism only represent experimental procedures, things you do in the lab. So for example, you just interpret a quantum state as representing some list of instructions of how to prepare a quantum system. And the most general preparation procedure is represented by a density operator on a complex Hilbert space. It might be a pure state, might be a mixed state. If you look at a measurement procedure, so something that takes in a system and generates some outcome, that it's represented by a positive operator valued measure. So these could be the spectral projectors of some observable, but they don't need to be. They could also just be positive operators. That's the most general sort of measurement. And the idea of an operational theory is it just gives you a prescription, an algorithm, for calculating the probabilities of different outcomes of this measurement given some preparation. And quantum mechanics gives us the Born rule as that algorithm. But if you favor realism, then you might say that's not enough as an interpretation. We would also like to be able to say that the system that comes out of this device has some physical properties. And it's those physical properties which are relevant to the measurement outcome. So I'm going to say that an ontological model of quantum theory is a realist interpretation that has the following sort of form. It posits ontic states. So a little lambda is going to denote the physical state of the system that passes between these devices. Capital lambda is the space of such states. And for every preparation procedure you have in the lab, you posit that there is some statistical distribution over physical states of the system that correspond to that preparation. Yes, Adrian.
Can I ask a better question?
Yeah.
I think there are going to be lots of questions for you. Rather than during the talk, sort of when the slide comes up or after the talk?
Let's go during for now, but maybe I'll change my answer later.
Okay. Then can I ask a real question?
Okay.
I would say that to be a realist, you don't have to be committed to any ontological model of quantum theory in the way you've just defined it.
I agree.
Do you agree with that?
I agree with that.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'll say
it's
more about
it. Special case of realism.
Yeah, it's a special case of realism. So, you know, if you're a realist, you might be inspired to do this sort of thing. So this is how you represent preparation procedures by distributions over the ontic states. A measurement is represented by a set of response functions. So they are functions that are of the form probability of the outcome x given the measurement and given the ontic state lambda. So for example, if you have a three outcome measurement, then this is what the response functions might look like. So if the ontic state's here, you definitely get outcome one. If it's over here, you might get outcome two or outcome two with certain probabilities. Obviously, these guys have to sum to one at every lambda as I sum over x. And so note, actually, there's an assumption that's gone in here, which I'm going to call lambda sufficiency. So the assumption is that the ontic state of the system screens off the preparation from the measurement. So the only thing that's relevant for the measurement, all the information about the preparation that's relevant to the measurement outcome is in the ontic state. So it's a sort of conditional independence. Yes?
For terminology, this assumption that lambda screens off the, is that what you would call a necessary assumption for the ontological model, or is that?
So I'm going to take this as part of the definition of an ontological model. But again, bearing in mind that I sort of see realist interpretations as a sort of broader category of thing than ontological models. I mean, it might be nice to have a name that was kind of less generic to say this is a very particular set of assumptions, but I'm just going to call it an ontological model. And these are the assumptions that go into it. So another, you know, implicit assumption is that the physical states of a system just describe its intrinsic properties as opposed to its relations to other things. That's all. I think there's there's a long list of implicit assumptions in this sort of model. And actually, I'm going to argue that, you know, actually it's one of those implicit assumptions we should abandon ultimately. So the idea of one of these models is that you reproduce the predictions of the operational formalism in this sort of way. The probability of lambda given p times the probability of the outcome x given lambda integrated over lambda should reproduce the quantum predictions. And so far, nothing I've told you rules out the possibility of such a model. In fact, we have such models and we can construct them. There's no problem. The problem is when you start adding assumptions to these models that somehow capture what you think are physically plausible assumptions about the universe. So one of the best known ones is Bell's assumption of local causality. So the idea here is that if you have two space-like separated regions, A and B, and you have some region that closes off the backward light cone of A, then the probabilities your theory assigns to regions in A, given a specification, a sufficient specification of the state, the ontic state of C, that's lambda C, and given some information about what's happening over here, is the same as the probability given this specification alone. So you can think of it this way. Learning something over here should teach you nothing about what's going on here if you already know everything here in the backward light cone. That's Bell's notion of local causality, which many of you probably know. And Bell's theorem tells us that a model, an ontological model of quantum theory that has this property does not exist, modulo some loopholes about superdeterminism and other crazy possibilities, which I won't go into. Another common no-go theorem is the Cochin Specker theorem. So there, what's at issue is not locality, but contextuality. And I've worked on generalizing the notion of non-contextuality beyond the traditional Cochin Specker notion. So I'm just going to tell you about those general notions. So the first is an assumption about preparations. I call it preparation non-contextuality. And it says if you have two preparations, P and P prime, so different lists of instructions of what to do in the lab, and they're equivalent operationally in the following sense. Every measurement you can do, every M, gives the same distribution of outcomes for P and for P prime. So no measurement you can do can tell these two preparations apart. In that case, you should assign the same statistical distribution over the ontic states. So the assumption here is that if there's nothing you can do in the lab to tell two preparations apart, then those preparations are of the same statistical ensemble of ontic states. You know, the reason you can't tell them apart, the intuition goes, is because there's nothing to distinguish them. You know, it's the same ensemble of ontic states that's coming out of both of them. So of course, there's no measurement that will tell them apart. So it's sort of an inference to the best explanation of this operational fact. In quantum theory, the equivalence classes of preparation procedures are described by the density operators. So everything that isn't doesn't affect the density operator can be considered part of the context of the preparation, something that's irrelevant to the measurement statistics. And so the assumption is that the distribution over ontic states depends only on the density operator and not on anything else. Okay, the other assumption is measurement non-contextuality. So it's the same idea. If you have two measurements, M and M prime, and you set them up with every possible preparation procedure, and you find that their statistics are exactly the same for every preparation procedure, then you infer that the response functions that you use to model them in your ontological model ought to be the same. So the idea here is that if nothing operationally can tell them apart, then they're measuring the same thing at the ontological level. And in quantum theory, the equivalence classes of measurements are represented by POVMs, positive operator valued measures. And so this assumption says that the response functions should depend only on the POVM and not on any other features. And what you can show is that an ontological model that assumes both of these things, I mean, they're sort of the same intuitions that go into this guy go into that guy. So the natural thing to assume is both of them. And any model that assumes them, you can derive a contradiction with the quantum statistics, modulo some loopholes, like Bell's theorem. Okay, so those tell you some constraints on what sorts of ontological models you can have. And now let's talk about another distinction, which is sort of orthogonal to these two. The ones, you know, these last two are the ones that people normally talk about. This is sort of a more recent phenomena that people, a more recent distinction people have been interested in. It's the distinction between psi-ontic and psi-epistemic ontological models. So this terminology was introduced in this paper I wrote with Nick Harrigan. So the idea of a psiontic model, roughly, is that the quantum state merely is real. It encodes information about reality in the following sense. If you have two preparation procedures, p psi 1 and p psi 2, that correspond to distinct quantum states, then nonetheless, the probability distribution over the ontic state for these two preparations don't overlap at all. So they're completely disjoint in the ontic state space. Yes? So the psi 1 and psi 2 are vectors in Hilbert space, and they are non-collinear. That's the assumption, okay? No, I'm going to assume that they're, okay, this not equals means non-collinear. So they don't just differ by, they can't just differ by a phase factor. They actually have to point in different directions in Hilbert space. That's right, yeah. So any two distinct rays in Hilbert space, the assumption of a psiontic model is that every such pair of distinct rays is represented by disjoint distributions.
So it's not continuous,
that's correct, yeah. Now, most of the hidden variable models of quantum mechanics we have are exactly of this form. If you take Bohmian mechanics, for example, the quantum state is part of what's posited to be real. And so if I take any two distinct quantum states, I'm talking about different realities. So that's the idea. In models where the quantum state is everything, these distributions just become delta distributions. In Bohmian mechanics, there are delta distributions along an axis of the state space, which describes, you know, what the quantum state is. But there's also some other axes, like the positions of the particles. And there, it's not a delta distribution. But the key feature is that in all those models, the distributions you associate with different quantum states don't overlap. Whereas in a psi epistemic model, when you have distinct rays, so you can find a pair of distinct rays such that the distributions that represent them do overlap. So the difference is really in whether the physical state encodes the quantum state or not. Here, if I tell you what the physical state is, I've also told you you can infer what the quantum state is, because every physical state is only consistent with one quantum state. So in a sense, a quantum state is a coarse-grained property of reality. Whereas here, if I tell you that the physical state is somewhere here in the common support of these two distributions, then it's consistent with both quantum states. And in that case, it makes more sense to say the quantum state characterizes our knowledge of that reality. And we can have different knowledge about the reality, we can have different states of knowledge with a, you know, one possible reality. Bill?
How would you still make the distinction between two versions of this psiontic, where the ontic state implies the wave function fundamentally, like in Bohmian mechanics, or sort of contingently, just as some kind of restriction on your knowledge, and that happens to be a restriction that where the distributions don't overlap?
The quantum state could be encoded in a complicated way in the underlying ontic state. Is that what you're saying? Not in the simple way of Bohmian mechanics, where it's sort of one of the degrees of freedom?
We're not going to infer any deeper theory than Bohmian mechanics. And the wave function really is fundamentally a property of the system.
Right. So Bohmian mechanics fits this description.
But other things do as well, don't they?
Sure.
I mean, a sort of epistemic model where there just wasn't any there wasn't any overlap between the distributions.
Okay. I'm not sure exactly what you're getting at, but here's a possible confusion. You know, the term epistemic might suggest to you that we're talking about a model where there is some extra variable in addition to the quantum state that we don't have knowledge about. So like Bohmian mechanics, there's sort of an epistemic component to Bohmian mechanics because, you know, we have a distribution over particle positions and we don't know where the position is. So I prefer the terminology psi complete versus psi incomplete. Is psi a complete description of reality or not? So that's, a psi incomplete model is just one where you've got some extra stuff, which you might not know about. But this distinction here is really about, whether the quantum state, variations of the quantum state correspond to variations in knowledge or variations in reality. So both Bohmian mechanics, which is psiontic, and psi epistemic models have in common the fact that there's going to be some statistical distribution over the underlying state space. They're both psi incomplete in my terminology. But that's not the distinction I'm interested in here. that would be a stronger notion of psi epistemicity. I mean, intuitively, you might want it. But strictly speaking, what I've done here is just said, if a model is not psi ontic, then it's psi epistemic. And the definition of psi ontic was that for every pair, this has to be true. So if it fails for even one pair, it's strictly speaking psi epistemic. But I agree with you. I mean, I think the only thing that makes one of these models natural is if it would kind of have a symmetry among all, you know, every pair of states that had the same overlap should have the same overlap in the hidden variable model. Okay. Good. So it turns out that there are sub-theories of quantum mechanics that have very compelling psi epistemic models. So for example, this Gaussian quantum mechanics or linear quantum optics is a sub-theory of quantum mechanics in the sense that it's a subset of all the preparations, measurements, and transformations that ordinary quantum mechanics allows. It's a large subset in the sense that you can get a lot of quantum phenomena in those theories, but it's not the full quantum theory. And if you restrict your attention, then you find that you can have a very nice representation of all possible experiments in terms of distributions over a classical phase space, transformations on the phase space, measurements over the phase space, and critically, non-orthogonal quantum states have to be represented by overlapping distributions. That you can also do it for discrete systems. So for the stabilizer theory of three-level quantum systems, you have, again, a discrete phase space, and you can do the same sort of tricks. And so I often talk about these things. I'm not going to talk about them today. They're the main reason for thinking that psi epistemic models are compelling. You know, what's nice about them is that they uphold principles of classical physics that are violated if you try to form a psi ontic model of the same subtheory. So if you take Bohmian mechanics and you say, what does it say about Gaussian quantum mechanics? It offers kind of a radical departure from your classical views of the world. In a region where it doesn't have to, because we know that we have these models that don't offer much of a departure from our classical worldview. Okay, so that's sort of part of the background of why these models are interesting. But a question arises, which is, could you find a psi epistemic ontological model for the full quantum theory, not just these sub-theories I've told you about? And to my knowledge, this was a question was first asked by Lucien around 2005 or so. And the answer is yes. Okay, I'm not going to end the talk here, but the answer is yes. So it turns out there's a model that Lucien and John Barrett and I worked on in 2006. I didn't have much to do with constructing the model itself, but it's an extremely ugly model that just proves, sort of as a proof of principle, that you can build such a thing that, strictly speaking, satisfies the definition. A better model has been proposed recently by these guys, but I mean, it's still the case that these models are really unappealing. I was going to say ugly, but I thought maybe that's uncharitable. They're unappealing. And so the question is, are there some interesting assumptions, which you might think of as criteria of beauty or appealingness, under which psi epistemic models are ruled out? Because, you know, we know that, strictly speaking, we can build them, but they're not very interesting. So we really want to know, what are the assumptions under which they're ruled out, if they're ruled out? And are there... are these assumptions such that they don't also rule out the psi ontic models? Like local causality would be great to have, but it simultaneously rules out the psi ontic and the psi epistemic ontological models. And so does non-contextuality.
I was wondering, these theories that satisfy the weaker definition of psi epistemic, or at least one pair of states?
Yeah, so like this first one was just sort of, you know, construct by hand one pair of states that overlaps and make everything else work out. So that was the sense in which it was very ugly. You know, this one's more sophisticated, but it picks out a direction Hilbert space is preferred, so it fails to have symmetries that you might want to have. Yeah. 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 John wrote something up. I mean, it's really my fault. I sort of said this is too ugly. Let's not publish it. But I shouldn't have. So yeah, if you want, you know, email John. He can send you a manuscript for that. Okay, so before I get into the PBR theorem and tell you my response to it, I just want to sort of tell you where we're going with this. So if you're a devoted realist, then here's a few options for you. You could just go for one of these psi ontic interpretations, so the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, Everett, collapse theories, or all of this sort. But if you choose to pursue the psi epistemic path, then you still have a choice to make. On the one hand, you could say, let's stick to this standard ontological model framework as I described it. And just admit that there's going to have to be contextuality and non-locality sort of hardwired into the theory. So you say, yeah, look, I'm going to change things here, and it's just going to have a causal influence over there. Let's just try to build a model that achieves that, or let's try to have contextuality in there by hand somehow. And this model I told you about is roughly like that. It sort of just tries to force those features into the theory. And so there's work to be done here, seeing you know how elegant can you make a theory of that sort. But another option is to instead reject some assumption of that standard ontological model framework, possibly an assumption that's implicit, one that it's not obvious we're making. You know, it's even hard to articulate, perhaps. And do that and try to somehow salvage the spirit of non-contextuality and of locality. So I take the spirit of those things to be that when you don't see a difference at the operational level in your experiments, you should not posit a difference at the ontological level. That's sort of what went on with non-contextuality. So it's the kind of thing that I personally would like to see preserved. And so I would put myself in this camp here. And so as Adrian said, you know, this ontological model framework is not the end of the story for a realist. You know, there's more to be done, but you know, maybe the kind of reality that these sorts of things posit isn't as familiar as the ones we're used to. Okay, so let me tell you about this new theorem called the PBR theorem. It's quite simple. I'm gonna look at it for just a pair of quantum states that are mutually unbiased. So the states zero and plus. They also have a version of this argument for any pair of non-orthogonal quantum states, but I'm not gonna go into that. It's sufficient to look at this case. So they imagine four different preparation procedures. So they have two level quantum systems, two qubits, each of which can be prepared either in the zero or the plus state. So plus denotes you know, the state zero coherently superposed with one over root two. And they choose each one of these uniformly at random, and they prepare one of these four states uniformly at random. Now, the assumption of their model is that I can think of the hidden variables of the two systems separately, and the distribution for a given choice of these two bits, x0 and x1, is just going to be a product distribution. Seems reasonable. I'll talk about the assumptions that go into this in a moment. And then they make the psi epistemic assumption, which says that for the two different states, zero and plus, you know, which are labeled here, the distribution over the hidden variables for that systems must overlap. Right? So we just saw that as the definition. So it means that they have different supports in the underlying ontic state space. So what that implies for the pair of systems now is that if I look at, for example, the zero, zero state, well, it has you know some support on lambda A and the same support on lambda B. But if I look at, say, the plus on A, zero on B state, well, it has a different support on lambda A, but that support overlaps with the support of the first guy. And it has the same support on lambda B. So its region of support will look like that. If I look at zero plus, it's here. And if I look at plus plus, it's here. And the point is that there exists some ontic states for the pair of systems, lambda A and lambda B, that are in the common support of all four of these preparation procedures, all four of the distributions associated with those preparations. Okay, and now to finish the theorem, they point out that there exists a measurement on the pair of qubits with four outcomes, and it's a measurement in this basis, which is an entangled basis, and it has the nice property that for the first preparation here, the first outcome of this measurement cannot occur, because you can verify easily that this quantum state is orthogonal to this guy. And for the second preparation, the second outcome can't occur, because this quantum state is orthogonal to this guy. And similarly for the third and the fourth. They can't occur for the third and the fourth preparations. So what it means is that if you think about the response functions for each of these guys, that's the representation in the ontological model, the response function for this guy has to assign probability zero to everything in the ontic support of this quantum state. If it didn't, then there'd be some probability of getting that outcome given the preparation of that quantum state. And we know that's not true. So this guy here has to assign probability zero to everything inside the red delineated region here. And the second guy has to assign probability zero to everything in the green region, and the third guy to everything in blue, and the fourth guy to everything in the black region. And so now we've just concluded that all of those response functions have to be zero in the region of common support. But we also know that the response functions have to add up to one everywhere in the ontic state space. That's the definition of a proper measurement. You always have to get some outcome no matter what the physical state is. So we have a contradiction. Yes?
On the left side, you have O and plus kind of states.
Yep.
On the right side, you have the minus.
Yeah, so the minus state is just ket 0 minus ket 1 over root 2. Sorry, this is quantum information terminology. I should have defined those on the slide. Yeah. So minus is just orthogonal to plus. Okay, so questions about that? Yes?
There must be some element of kind of that you're saying that there's just some chance, there has to be some chance that A
is the ontic state. And then there's only one outcome, right? So.
Well, there's only one measurement happening. The counterfactuals are in which of the four preparations you're doing. So these are the four outcomes of a single measurement, but these are four alternative possibilities for the preparation, not all of which can be done simultaneously. Obviously, you have to choose one of them. So there are counterfactuals in this proof, just as any other Sachinogo theorem. But unlike most, they appear here in the choice of preparations. So first, let me ask: was that sufficiently clear? Is it obvious how the contradiction is derived? Okay. So let's go through the assumptions of the theorem, because that's what's interesting about no-go theorems. They're all based on assumptions, and the question is, you know, what does it teach us that we have to abandon? So the first assumption that PBR point out is what I've called lambda sufficiency. So just the fact that lambda screens off P from M. And as I said, that's basically a common assumption for all no-go theorems. I take it to be part of the definition of the standard ontological model framework, and I'm not going to say much more about it. The second assumption I'll call separability in the ontic support of product states, or just separability PS. So let me tell you what that means. So first of all, yes?
Were those four states complete? I mean,
they don't form a basis, no, because you're preparing one or another of them. And so if you look back at them, they are not orthogonal. But that's what we needed, right? Because the assumption of a psi epistemic model is that non-orthogonal quantum states will have overlapping distributions. So by necessity, they needed to consider some preparations corresponding to non-orthogonal quantum states. These four are the four outcomes of a single measurement. So they are orthogonal. I mean, it's not totally obvious looking at them. But if you do the calculation, they are complete. This is a four-dimensional Hilbert space, because it's qubit, tensor, qubit. And so you expect there to be a four states in the basis. Okay, so what's this assumption of separability? So first let me tell you a basic assumption of separability, which is the idea, it's an assumption about composite systems. So if capital lambda denotes the ontic state space for a system, the assumption of separability is that when you look at the ontic state space of A and B, this composite, it's just the Cartesian product of the ontic state space for A with the ontic state space of B. And what that means is that the physical states of the composite can be specified just by specifying the physical states of the components. So it's effectively an assumption of reductionism, that there aren't any holistic properties that arise for the composite that isn't defined in terms of the properties of the components. So you can have some properties like, say, the center of mass, which is not, you know, simply a property of any given component, but is defined in terms of the properties of the components. So that's the assumption of separability. Now, note that if you look at the space in which the epistemic states live, so these are the probability distributions over the ontic states. They're just functions from the ontic state space to the positive reals. Well, it's the tensor product of the epistemic state spaces for the components. It's not the Cartesian product, because the Cartesian product here would just be the product distributions. And we know that there's more valid distributions over the pair of systems than just the product distributions. There's also things like this guy, linear combinations of the product distributions. So to support all these distributions, you need to close the Cartesian product under linear combination, so you get the tensor product. So right here you see sort of one of the, you know, key motivations for the psi epistemic approach. It says, look, we can preserve this good old principle of reductionism separability and understand the tensor product that arises in quantum mechanics if we grant that quantum states are epistemic beasts, because epistemic things tend to combine by tensor products, whereas ontic things tend to combine by Cartesian products. Yes?
So,
Bohmian mechanics, for example, postulates that the wave function is a real thing, but it doesn't exist at any one point. Quantum mechanics is the only place where people really entertain this kind of holism, so I can't point you to other theories where it arises. But, I think the idea of this kind of holism should be clear. It's saying that the paradigm of classical field theory, which says, we can describe the universe one point of space-time at a time, is wrong. That's what a failure separability means. Einstein famously said that, he could barely imagine doing science if separability failed. But many people have thought that that's too strong and that you can entertain a possibility of failure of separability. Yes?
I mean, despite the Einstein quote, and although it's a very different example, isn't GR another illustration of holism?
In what sense? Most of these discussions are made in the context of flat background space-time.
Yeah.
But I'm curious to know if GR really...
I suppose at least in the naive sense, it doesn't really make sense to talk about a manifold except as a whole thing. You can't sort of cut out a little piece of it and say this.
Yeah, you could say something like that. But is the topology, say, of a manifold like the center of mass? Can it be defined ultimately in terms of its components, or is there something new that arises that can't be defined in terms of the components?
Well, I think the latter, right? Can't really talk about the topology if you always look at the local properties.
It's a good question. Let me not dwell on it. Let's put it aside for now. Because in the end, I'm actually going to argue that I think separability versus non-separability is not the right question to be asking. So PBR does not assume this. They assume instead this separability in ontic support of product states. So they admit that there can be these holistic properties, but they say that there's a subset of the ontic states, which is just the union of the supports of the distributions describing product quantum states. Take all those ontic states that are inside the ontic support of product states. They say, that's going to be part of a Cartesian product of state spaces for the individual components. So the idea is that product states will only assign non-zero probability to these factorizable ontic states. Entangled states, however, might have to assign non-zero probability to some funny holistic things. So that's the second assumption. And then there's a third assumption, which is that product quantum states are represented by product distributions. I'll call that factorization for product states. And that's just, so now that you can grant that lambda AB is just lambda A comma lambda B, then I can talk about the distribution over those two guys, and it's supposed to factorize. Seems like a plausible assumption. This is a product state after all. So here's the synopsis of the theorem. Lambda sufficiency, together with the separability assumption and factorization assumption, and the psi epistemic assumption, implies a contradiction. So the argument they make is, these things are plausible, so it's the psi epistemic that has to go. And we have to look for psi ontic ontological models. So first point I want to make contra that conclusion. Suppose you did replace separability for product states by just separability. To some extent, that's the more natural assumption. And in fact, speaking to many people about the PBR result, I find that most people assume that that's actually what they're assuming. They're just assuming separability. It's totally natural. And this caveat about just for product states, doesn't sort of make it into people's consciousness typically. But note that in a psi-ontic model, separability fails. And it fails in a trivial way. So a psi-ontic model says that the complete physical state of a pair of systems is given by the quantum state together with some other variables. So there can be other stuff. But the quantum state is in there. It's encoded in the complete physical state. And so that means that the projective Hilbert space for the composite, which is the ontic state space, which is part of the ontic state space, can't be written as the Cartesian product. We know it can't be written as the Cartesian product of the projective Hilbert spaces for the components because it's the tensor product. There are entangled states which can't be factorized. So just the very existence of entangled states says, in a synontic model, you cannot have separability. You know, the end. And the argument's quite trivial. And just, there's some nice quotes from Einstein that suggest that, you know, way back, he was already thinking a bit psi epistemically, and he was pointing to this fact about the quantum state as evidence against thinking of it as a real thing. You know, the fact that entangled states exist. But of course, if you assume separability, then you can still run the PBR argument. You know, separability implies separability for product states. And so now you can show that, you know, even the psi epistemic models, contrary to whatever Einstein might have thought, the psi epistemic models, against the background of these other assumptions, cannot preserve separability. So you could think of the PBR result as, you know, a nice little proof that separability, in the context of these other assumptions, cannot be had regardless of how one interprets the quantum state. So the point is that if you think of that separability is the natural assumption, not this other one, then you just say, look, we can't have these guys together. They just lead to a contradiction regardless of how you think about the quantum state. And that's a very different conclusion from the one that the title of the PBR paper announces. So if you're motivated to adopt separability, then you're going to need to do something beyond just going for psiontic models. All right, but let me talk now, say one more thing about the separability stuff, which is that if you're a psiontist or a Scientologist, then the idea that entangled states should be associated with holistic properties will be very natural to you. I mean, the picture a lot of people have is kind of like a, you know, two entangled states systems have a string between them. You know, you pull one and the other one moves immediately. But of course, for a psi epistemicist, the entangled states are not part of the ontology. They're just an epistemic notion, like a kind of mutual information. And so for the PBR theorem to count as evidence in favor of a psiontic approach, I think an argument has to be provided for why this separability on product states is a natural assumption when you can't have separability itself. And they have to provide that argument that doesn't appeal to intuitions that assume an ontic interpretation of the quantum state, because that would make the argument circular. So that's my challenge. Let's move on to factorization. Here's what the assumption looked like. Remember my definition of preparation non-contextuality. It said that if you can't distinguish two preparation procedures, then they should be represented the same way. Well, you can think of this second preparation procedure here as part of the context of the first preparation procedure. Because it's true that no matter what measurement I do over here on A, the statistics I get don't depend at all on what I've chosen to prepare for B. You know, whether I've done one quantum state here or another one, it doesn't affect the statistics over here for product states. And so this is true. And so it follows from preparation non-contextuality that the distribution over lambda A, the physical states of A, shouldn't depend on the preparation procedure for B. And so now I want to show you that you can derive this factorization assumption assuming this, together with a little bit more. So here's what classical probability theory would tell you about the joint distribution of these guys. So I've just decomposed it. And now if you grant that lambda A doesn't depend on lambda B when you've conditioned on the preparations, let's call that lambda independence, then you get to two terms that look just like the left-hand side of this equation. So now non-contextuality allows you to rewrite it like this. So lambda A doesn't depend on the preparation on B, lambda B doesn't depend on the preparation on A. That's the factorization assumption. So in a sense, I think what the factorization assumption seems natural or is appealing for the same reasons that preparation non-contextuality is appealing. You know, it seems like, you know, why should lambda A depend on preparations on B over here? You know, none of the measurements you do on it see that difference, so it's sort of implausible that physically there should be a dependence. But that's exactly the intuition of non-contextuality. Another point you can make about this is that if you chose to do those two preparations at space-like separation, then you could just appeal to Bell's notion of local causality to justify this factorization assumption they make in the theorem. Because again, you know, neither, you know, lambda A won't depend on the preparation over here by virtue of locality. And note, of course, that both local causality and preparation non-contextuality, sort of considered as general principles, by themselves contradict the predictions of quantum theory. You don't need to make any other assumptions. And this is true regardless of whether you take a psiontic or a psi epistemic approach. So my conclusion then is that for of this part is that for the PBR theorem to count as evidence for a psiontic approach, it seems to me that an argument has to be provided for why we should seek to salvage the particular instance of preparation non-contextuality or local causality which the theorem posits when we can't have these features in general. If the only real reasons we can give for these assumptions are the same motivating reasons we give for the more general assumptions, then we know that we can't, you know, do justice to those reasons with a psiontic model because we have these other no-go theorems that rule it out. All right, so I want to move into the sort of more kind of going beyond PBR part of the talk. So the first thing I want to talk about is how maybe we were too quick with our analysis of separability. So there's something interesting here. So on first glance, as I said, separability clearly fails for psiontic models because there's entangled states. You know, they can't be separable. But if you think a bit more carefully about it, you realize, well, it depends on how what assumptions you make about the association between quantum state and regions of space-time. And so a few years back, I had a nice email correspondence with Travis Norson on whether it's possible to build a hidden variable model, no matter how ugly, which achieves separability. You know, Bohmian mechanics doesn't do it. None of the models, standard models, do it. They fail to be locally causal in Bell sense, but they also fail to be separable. And so the question was, well, can we build this model? And we realized that actually you can do it trivially. You say, you know, here's an example. You do Bohmian mechanics, but you put a copy of the universal wave function at every point in space-time. And so the Bohmian particle positions know how to move based on, you know, the copy of the universal wave function they see at that point. So now I can specify the physical state point by point. There's nothing that extends, you know, has holistic properties, and it makes the same predictions. Or I could put the universal wave function at the center of the universe, or at the back of my mailbox. It would non-locally have to influence all the other particles in the universe, but we fail to satisfy Bell's notion of local causality anyhow. So I can always put it in one spot and just explain the dynamics by those non-local influences. So there's this trivial way in which you can achieve separability. And for me, the moral of the story is that the distinction between kinematics and dynamics doesn't seem to be fundamental. I could give you lots of other examples. I don't really have time today, but lots of other examples, I think, where it seems clear that the distinction between kinematics and dynamics is conventional in Poincaré's sense, you know, that the distinction between physics and geometry is conventional. And it's only the combination of these two things that really makes predictions. So whenever you have this sort of conventional distinction, you're led to wonder, well, you know, what can we talk about? What's the conceptual scheme where the physics is encoded? You know, what's really important? And so I'm going to argue that it's the causal structure. And so notions of separability should not be what occupy us, but rather notions of causal structure. This is also going to help to clarify certain connections between different no-go theorems. So that's where we're going. All right, I have to tell you about how to represent causality, or how I'm going to do it. And I'm drawing this all from a literature which is not very familiar to physicists. It comes from the machine learning community and some philosophers and people in medicine. But if you're interested, you can find summaries in these two books. The idea is this. If you have a set of classical random variables, then the mathematical formalism that represents the causal relations among them is just a directed acyclic graph. So the arrows here represent direct causal connections between variables. You want it to be acyclic so that there are no causal loops. But you need to add to that graph some extra parameters, which tell you something about the strength of the causal connections. So for example, it could be that, you know, y is a deterministic function of its causal parents, v and x in this example. And z would be some deterministic function of its causal parents. So that would be, again, part of the causal model. And then I would have to say something about the statistical distributions over the variables that have no parents, like v, w, and x, in order to infer distributions over y and z. So these are sort of epistemic components, whereas the rest are the ontological components of the causal model. Now, generally, we don't have access to all the variables that are causally relevant. So people tend to write down causal models where they admit that there may be some other variables that are not specified, which causally influence the variables in the model. And so, for example, it could be that y is only probabilistically determined from v and x, because there's actually some other variable that influences y, and you don't have knowledge of that variable, or you have some, you know, uncertainty about it. So this is the more general paradigm for causal models, where I have conditional probabilities of every node given its parents in the causal structure. The assumptions that go into this, well, the different conditionals are autonomous causal connections. So you know the parameters here are not correlated with the parameters here. Parentless nodes are uncorrelated with one another, so these you know all factorize. And the overarching philosophy here is that any correlations should be explained causally. And so you should put it into your model. If you have a correlation, you have to explain it in your model. So if you want V and W to be correlated, fine. Put another node and you know, explain how they're correlated by a causal mechanism. That's the idea. Okay, so once you've got a causal model on the table, you can make inferences about the joint distribution over all the variables and the kinds of independences you'll see in that distribution. So the independences I'm interested in are conditional independences. So X and Y are conditionally independent given Z means any of the following three equivalent things. So look at the first one. The first one says that in the context of already knowing Z, learning Y teaches you nothing about X. The second one says in the context of already knowing Z, learning X teaches you nothing about Y. That's equivalent. Or you could say in the context of already knowing Z, X and Y are uncorrelated. They all are equivalent by, you know, you can just do by the definition of conditional probability. So I'm just going to denote it in this way here. And so you can derive a whole lot of conditional independences by knowing the causal model. So here's a nice little theorem. It says that any node in the model will be independent of its non-descendants given its parents. So once you condition on the causal parents of a variable, if I go and tell you something about some other variable, which is not one of the effects of that variable, then it doesn't give you any extra information because you already know its parents, right? So you know, once I've told you what the values of the parent variables are, you can make all the predictions about that variable you like. If I told you the values of some of its effects, you might be able to make more predictions. But if I tell you the variables of some other non-descendants, well, they might be correlated via the parents or via the descendants, but they're not going to give you any more information about X. So you can derive a whole lot of conditional independence relations for any causal model using this theorem. And then you know these different independences combined give you more independences, and there's a whole theory of how you get those out. And then in addition to those, these dependencies all just depend on the structure. There's some other independences that come from you know, the particular parameters of your model. And so for example, in this particular case, it turns out that Y and W are conditionally independent given V. So that's one of the independencies you can derive. I want to come up with a quantum analog of all this. But to do that, I need a notion of conditional probability. Now this is the hard part. That I mean, there's a whole lot to be said about the quantum analog of this whole causal model business, and I don't have time to do it in this talk. So I'm gonna sort of rush through it, and I hope you get a flavor for it. And if you're interested in it, you can you know look at the papers. But I don't expect you to sort of you know follow everything that I'm doing. So the rough idea is to come up with a quantum theory of Bayesian inference which parallels the classical theory, by making quantum states the analogs of probability distributions. The trace is the analog of marginalization. States on tensor products of Hilbert spaces is the analog of a joint distribution. Here's partial trace, analog of partial marginalization. And then finally the question is, well, what's the analog of this conditional state? So what does it need to satisfy? Well, we're going to take it to be an operator on the tensor product of B and A. That's kind of natural because the joint distribution, its analog was a tensor it was a state on the tensor product, and this is also a function of two variables. So it's sort of its natural mathematical analog will be the same sort of object. So we're going to take it to be this kind of object. And now what we know about conditional probabilities is that they satisfy this normalization condition. For every value of R, if I sum over S, I get one. So think of this as a relation between two functions. The left-hand side is a function over the variable r. The right-hand side is also a function over the variable r, just the uniform function. So we have a good analog of the uniform function. It's just identity. So the natural mathematical analog of this thing is just the trace over b of rho b given a is equal to identity on a. So bear in mind that rho b given a, that's just a notation for an object on b tensor a. Okay, so once you've got this definition, you can find an analog of the usual way of defining a conditional in terms of the joint and the marginal. It's just this thing here, where you multiply by negative 1/2 of rho a on both sides. And I'm going to rewrite this in this sort of form. Just drop the identities and the tensor products, because the subscripts always tell you what commutes with what. This is Matt Leifer's proposal for a conditional state. OK, you can solve for the joint in terms of the conditional. You can write down a formula for belief propagation, which is analogous to this one. So if these are my beliefs about A, and this is my conditional B given A, well, this is what I should believe about B. You can easily derive that. You can also derive a Bayes theorem, where, you know, if I have a conditional A given B, I can find B given A just in a few steps which parallel the classical proof. So I have all the components of a theory of Bayesian inference, but in terms of operators. What's going to be useful for me are cases where we're talking about classical systems or hybrids of classical and quantum. So you can incorporate all of that into this framework by just using diagonal operators. So, you know, if I have a variable that's near the end of the alphabet, that'll be a classical system, so x, y, z. And so a quantum state, rho x, can just be written as in terms of some probability distribution, like this. If I have a hybrid, like y and a, so y is classical, a being near the beginning of the alphabet is quantum, then it has to be diagonal in some preferred basis just on the y component. So it can be arbitrary over here. And now the point is that if I look at the properties of this guy, right, it has to be positive and it has to have this trace condition satisfied. Positivity implies that these guys are positive. The trace condition, when you work it out, shows that these guys have to sum to identity. So this encodes a POVM. So all the information in the POVM is really contained in one of these classical given quantum conditionals. So I can represent POVMs this way. They're natural objects. So for example, if I have a measurement, a quantum system A undergoes a measurement, spits out a classical outcome Y, well, then normally I write the Born rule like this. Probability is given the POVM and the state. I can now write it as just a simple example of belief propagation. You have some beliefs about A. You propagate them through your characterization of the measurement. You get your beliefs about Y. You can do the same thing if it's the other kind of conditional, quantum given classical. You can prove that this is just associated with a set of normalized states. So again, you use the properties you know, and you prove that all these guys are trace one states. And so if I have a set of preparation procedures, so a classical preparation variable and a quantum state that depends on that, well, instead of writing them in the normal thing where I average those quantum states with my prior over x, I can just, again, write it as belief propagation, rho x to rho a. So finally, if you have a prepare and measure scenario, you know, you can write the probabilities of the different outcomes just in this simple, you know, two applications of belief propagation. And this is the beginning of a quantum causal model. That's the point of all this, that this is starting to look a lot like those classical causal models. So now, you know, if I had a much more complicated situation with some quantum systems and some classical systems and some quantum states and quantum conditionals for all of them, that would be a quantum causal model. So I've replaced the probability distributions, the conditional probabilities, with these conditional states. And we haven't got a full theory of these things yet. We can't deal with arbitrary causal structures, but we're working on it, and we're making progress, and we're getting more and more of them. And so hopefully, eventually, we could do it for arbitrary causal structure. Now, you get the same thing here, that when you have a notion of independence that you can infer from the causal structure. So you can just write it in terms of identities on these conditional states. Now, this characterization is only true if two of these three variables are classical. It's more complicated in general, and I don't want to bore you with the complications. But I'm only going to be interested in those cases. So that's fine. And you get an analog of the Markov condition, and you get some independences that follow from the particular details of these guys rather than the causal structure. It's all basically the same. OK, so here's the point. When you do all of this, you find that, you know, an ontological model is basically a classical causal model of your quantum scenario. But now you have a powerful way of describing the quantum scenario that looks a lot like this. And so there's a natural assumption that suggests itself, at least it did to me, was that you should try to track the independences that you see in the quantum case over here in the classical case. So let me define that as a new kind of condition you might want your ontological model to satisfy, like local causality or non-contextuality or something like that. I'll call it the eye-tracking condition, independence tracking. And it turns out this is a really useful umbrella principle that implies essentially all the others. Okay, so let's see some examples of that. Lambda sufficiency, that really simple one. Well, I know that my measurements on A don't depend on how I've prepared A. And in my our notation, that just is this formula, which means that Y and X are independent given A. So I say, well, that must be true in the underlying model. And the way I represent it is that the probabilities of Y given lambda A and X are just the probabilities of Y given lambda A. That's the lambda sufficiency assumption, the screening off. So we get quantum screening off. Therefore, we should have screening off in the ontological model. Or if you look at measurement non-contextuality, it says that when you look at the measurement on A, which is a row Y given A, and C, where C is some context variable, you find that you don't need to condition on C. And therefore, you have a certain screening off. You should assume it applies in the ontological model as well. So you say, well, the context is not important for these representations either. So you get measurement non-contextuality. Preparation non-contextuality, you also have an irrelevant context variable. It's gone. What about local causality? Well, it's a bit more complicated, but we, you know, local causality is, well, okay, in the quantum context, we know that an observable on A and B, these are two quantum systems, really, you know, which can be written in this form, is represented in our formalism this way, which implies these independences. X is independent of these guys given its parents. So I just take those independences over here, and I work it out, and I find that's Bell's notion of local causality. So we have that one too. Okay. Connection to separability. If you lump A and B together as just one node in this graph, well, you can still represent the measurement on AB as a product of two other measurement operators on AB that happen to have this form. And in our formalism, that's just writing this conditional as this product of conditionals. And in terms of independences, that means that I can think of X as independent of Y and T given AB and S. So I still have some independences. Even though separability might be gone, I've lumped these two guys together now, I've still got some independences to work with. So I can still infer something from those independences. And this is what I infer, you know, the analogous independences in the underlying model. And this also is Bell's notion of local causality, but it's the one wherein you don't assume that lambda A, B separates into two components. And you know, Bell noted this himself. He said that, you know, what's interesting is that his assumption about locality doesn't even require that the hidden variable lambda be localizable. It could be like a quantum mechanical state vector, which has no particular localization in ordinary space-time. So Bell's notion already incorporated this possibility of failure separability. And to my mind, the way to do it is to look at these kinds of conditional independences, which is how Bell did it. But we should do it more generally. So finally, we can get back to PBR, and if we look at the factorization for product states assumption, we see that it follows from the eye tracking condition. So this is a statement about the preparation of AB given S and T preparation variables. It factorizes in the quantum formalism. So I get these independences, and if I turn that into statements about the hidden variables, it's just the factorization condition. But now the cute thing is that we can again find some independences that don't require us to separate A and B. We can say A and B have non-separable properties and still get some interesting implications. So first, I want you to note that in this classical model here, S and T are independent given A and B. So that follows because, so this is a little Bayesian inversion calculation. So I want to know what the row of ST given AB is. Here's the Bayesian inversion formula. I plug in what I know about rho AB given ST. That's this. I know that rho AB factorizes. I reorganize terms. I do another Bayesian inversion. And I get, finally, because rho S given A is the same as rho S given AB, I get this kind of factorization of rho ST given AB. This final equation is a statement of independence. It doesn't matter if you didn't follow the proof. You can prove it. And now I can just assume that. So I've lumped A and B together, and I said, you know, who knows? They might be non-separable. But I know that this independence holds. And now if I use my eye tracking criterion, I get this kind of independence in the hidden variable model. And then you just have to do a few more manipulations to calculate. You know, it turns out rho AB given ST can be written in this nice form. It's called a quantum pooling rule. There's an analogous classical pooling rule, which says whenever this independence holds, you can always write the distribution over this variable given these variables as a product of this given that, divided by the overall distribution. So I just call that poolability. So now I've gotten rid of the separability assumption altogether. in PBR, replaced it with this assumption. Turns out you can still get their conclusion. So here's how it works. Poolability tells you that this joint, this distribution over the lambda for the composite factorizes in this way. But we know for our non-orthogonal quantum states that each one of these factors is going to be greater than zero. There exists some ontic state where these guys are positive for both values of s and both values of t. And therefore, there exists some ontic state where it's positive for their product. So again, I say, even though this thing's non-separable, for all four of these different product preparations, there's some ontic state that is assigned a non-zero probability. And then you can just run the proof as before, because there shouldn't exist a measurement that can distinguish these four guys if they all have some ontic state in common. All right. So you can replace those assumptions with this poolability assumption. It's very similar to some points that were made in this paper by Michael Hall. So this is my contribution to trying to get rid of the kinematics dynamics conventional distinction in the PBR proof, in much the same way that in Bell's proof we don't have that distinction. All right, so let me just wrap up with some conclusions. So this eye tracking condition I've introduced, it implies all of these common assumptions of no-go theorems. And it seems to me that it is perhaps the overarching principle that makes all of these assumptions seem plausible to us. So maybe what we should be really asking for is this kind of tracking of the independences that exist in the quantum causal model in our classical model. Note that you can satisfy this eye, the fact that your intuition is that you should satisfy this condition might be part of what makes the psi epistemic models of Gaussian quantum mechanics and stabilizer theory for qubits appealing, because in those models you have eye tracking, so all of these things hold, the whole eye tracking condition is satisfied. But suppose that you're committed to this standard ontological model framework and you want your eye tracking condition satisfied, then presumably what you want to do is say, I can't have it for full quantum theory, but let's try to have it as much as we can. That's the sort of guiding principle. And the problem is that you have to say what you mean by as much as we can. So these psiontic models, well, they can achieve this poolability stuff, for example, right? They can achieve the factorization. They can do it for the full quantum theory, while psi epistemic models can only do it in certain subtheories, like Gaussian quantum mechanics. They can only achieve these principles in those subtheories. But on the other hand, psi epistemic models can achieve things like local causality and preparation non-contextuality in subtheories of quantum mechanics, where psiontic models can't achieve them at all. So which is better? Do we want to have all of something or some of everything? Do we want all of the eye tracking consequences for some of quantum theory, or just two of these special consequences for all of quantum theory? So to my mind, that's the important question. I would say, it's better to try to do justice to this condition and abandon the standard framework. And so something has to give in the framework. That's the way I see the right conclusion to take from all of this. We have to be more imaginative. So here's an idea, and this is basically the last thing I'm going to say. Sorry for going over time. Maybe we should look at this inability of the classical model to parallel the quantum model as a clue that we want something that we shouldn't have. So here's my last quote. It's from Spoonboy from The Matrix. Do not try and reproduce independences of quantum conditional states in classical conditional probabilities. That's impossible. Instead, only try to realize the truth. There are no classical conditional probabilities. Then you'll see that not only must our conception of reality bend, but also our conception of how we ought to reason about reality. So not only do we have to imagine sort of different ontologies to do justice to the quantum formalism. What is the correct theory of Bayesian inference could be considered something that's not a priori, is empirical. The theory we use to reason about the world is something that's constrained by the physics of the world. After all, I am a physical object that interacts with the world, so the way I reason could clearly depend on how the laws, what's the most adaptive way for me to update my knowledge in the face of uncertainty. That could clearly depend on the laws of physics. So one possibility is that the right formalism for Bayesian inference is the quantum formalism. We're not going to replace those with classical probabilities. But what we need to understand is some way of thinking about the underlying reality that implies that that's the correct formalism for an agent to use to update their knowledge. And so we need to have some notion of the way reality might be for that to be the case. So let me end there. Thanks.
Could you clarify the sentence, there are no classical conditional probabilities?
Well, that was sort of to keep with the style of this original quote from The Matrix. But the spirit was that, you know, as we seek ontological models in the standard framework, what we're trying to do is, you know, replace a quantum description with a description in terms of classical conditional probabilities. So we replace our quantum systems with hidden variables.
But I mean, as an independent yep. sentence, independent of quantum theory, yep. is it true? I can't believe it.
Well, no, you have to give me poetic license. I'm not saying that there does not exist a mathematical object called the classical conditional probability. What I'm saying is that perhaps in the most adaptive theory of Bayesian inference that we as agents trying to survive in the world can use, when we try to describe quantum systems, ultimately we cannot describe our knowledge by classical conditional probabilities over state spaces, ontic state spaces. We must use quantum conditional operators to describe our knowledge. That's the idea I was trying to capture here.
Could you say for maybe the unpersuaded, mm-hmm. why you use the word compelling when you're talking about the psi epistemic models for restricted versions of quantum theory? Because, I mean, there's a counter
yeah.
thought which says you hide away from the real complexities of quantum theory, you look at restricted cases, of course you can achieve much more. How do you tell from the outside whether you've got compelling evidence that this program is going somewhere or not? What criteria should be used?
Well, what I said was that the psi-epistemic models of certain sub-theories of quantum mechanics are compelling.
Yep.
Let's make that a distinct claim from, you know, the whole psi-epistemic program is compelling. Let's just say, you know, do we have compelling models of those sub-theories of quantum mechanics? And the sense in which I mean that was, there was a time when I used to work on modal interpretations, which are like, you know, Bohmian interpretations. And what you have to do to make those things work is you have to abandon almost everything you knew about classical reality. You have to abandon locality, you have to abandon reductionism, you have to abandon the idea that there's an action-reaction principle or symplectic structure in the underlying physical state space, that, you know, classical probability theory holds, that determinism holds. Pretty much anything you knew about classical physics, it's out the window, all in the service of trying to shoehorn this interpretation and make it work. Now, if you instead just take on board this idea that quantum states are states of knowledge, that's a category change in what kind of thing you're talking about. It's a radical difference. And for these sub-theories of quantum theory, everything you knew and loved about classical physics still holds true. The one innovation you have to take on board is that unlike a classical world, we don't know everything. But that's it. And that's relatively mild compared to everything you had abandoned in these psiontic approaches. So my claim is that if the world were described by one of these sub-theories rather than the full theory, then I think it would be crazy to adopt a psiontic model rather than a psi-epistemic model, just by our, you know, by virtue of its sort of continuity with previous theories and its greater intuitiveness and elegance. So that's the claim. Do you have a response?
okay. Well, I suppose the response would be to try to press you further on where you think the epistemic program, what the status is and how compelling it is, given that the world is described by full quantum theory rather than by the sub.
So we're agreeing that had the world been described by these sub-theories, then a psi-epistemic model would have been preferable, is better.
For the moment,
yeah. Okay.
I don't want to contest
good,
that. Moment,
good,
yeah.
Good, good.
Yeah.
So now the question is, what are the prospects for a psi-epistemic model of everything, the full quantum theory?
Yeah, I mean, so, yeah, yes.
So I think, if you try to stick to the standard ontological model framework and try to build in contextuality and non-locality by hand, then in fact, you have to put more than just that in, in by hand. I mean, there's sort of all this stuff that you've got to throw in there, which, you know, violates these classical intuitions. You know, probably action reaction will have to go. You know, maybe everything has to go, much like I was saying, you know, these modal interpretations. And so I'm not particularly inspired to do that. And I've never thought that, you know, the result of the what we should take away from Bell's theorem or the Cochin-Specker theorem, if we want to be realists, is that we have to have, you know, hardwired non-locality. It's always seemed to me that it's a bit, you know, there's some implicit assumption we're making that has to be wrong. And if we identify that, then we can sort of have the spirit of all these principles preserved. So I sort of imagine it a bit like the situation with special relativity. You know, you could look at Einstein's two postulates, say, you know, prior to Einstein figuring out that you could derive the Lorentz transformations from these postulates. And you could say, well, look, you know, these two postulates seem contradictory, you know, the light postulate and the relativity postulate. How could they both be true? It doesn't make any sense. But to figure out how they could both be true, you basically need to get to the end. You need to, you know, reconceptualize space-time, figure out that you had some implicit assumptions about the absolute nature of simultaneity. You have to go through all that, and only at the end can you see how to sort of resolve that conflict. And so my hope is that we can, you know, the kind of tension that we see currently in quantum theory between things like no signaling and the existence of non-locality will go away once we figure out which implicit assumption we need to abandon, analogously to, say, the absolute nature of simultaneity. So that's my hope. And I think it's I'm very hopeful. I think it could work. And I mean, so far there doesn't seem to me to be any real obstacle. But of course, it's again just a question of, you know, limitation of imagination. So, you know, no-go theorems are great because they'll refine what it is we need to change.
Any more questions? Let's thank Rob Witzel.